Before we get started with today's show, I wanted to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, Baseball Tonight with Buster Olney. It's the number one baseball podcast for a reason. Top executives, managers, players, and the best analysis in the game. Follow along all postseason with new episodes every weekday. Be sure to check it out. You can download and subscribe to Baseball Tonight as well as The Right Time wherever you get your podcasts. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, I'm going to talk about what is the one thing about Derrick Henry I don't feel like people are talking about. Also, this crazy situation going on at the University of Texas with their school song. But first... All right, so, Gabe, I don't know if you've noticed this, but the Cowboys are not very good. And one thing I actually think is interesting about the Cowboys, as we talk about the fact that they have not won a Super Bowl in 25 years, they have not been to a Super Bowl in 25 years. Let's think what else we could rattle off they haven't done in 25 years. Oh, they have not been to a conference championship in 25 years. I don't know if you saw this, but last night during the game, the ESPN team ran through all the teams that have not been to a conference championship in the last 25 years. And let me tell you what that was. A collection of bums. Gabe, it was the Bills, the Dolphins, Washington, the Bengals, the Browns, the Lions. I think I got everybody. Like, the Cowboys are better than all of them. Like, we could agree with that, that in the course of these last 25 years, that they have been better than all of those teams that I rattled off. But, man, the Cowboys are surrounded by bums. Like, that is their company. That is who's around them in the last 25 years on the high end of things is a bunch of bums. But what the Cowboys really haven't been that much, though, in this time is just laughably bad. Right? Like that has not happened. They had those 3-5-11 seasons with Dave Campo where they seemed more just kind of meh than they did just like terribly and laughably bad. They had the year when Romo got hurt in 2015, and I want to say they went 4-12, but you go back, you see a lot of one score games or whatever. But I don't remember them just being like as hilarious that year as they are this year, because this year they are hilarious. They were hilarious before Dak got hurt because your boy Zeke can't hold on to the ball to save his life. I don't know what's going on with that one, right? Like he just keeps fumbling over and over and over and over again. And the Dak wound up getting hurt. And remember, some of y'all was out here thinking that somehow maybe this would mess things up for Dak in his pursuit of getting his money. And to be fair to the Cowboys, Stephen Jones has been clear that he says this injury doesn't change anything about the way that they view Dak. They view him as their quarterback of the future. Like, I don't think the fact that they haven't extended him is an indicator that they don't think he's good. They just try to get over. You know, they just try to get the cheapest deal that they possibly can on him. But if you for a moment thought that Andy Dalton might be the answer, and a whole bunch of y'all did think that. I saw a bunch of people on television that was out here trying to make that argument that it was going to work out okay. Tony Dungy tried to make the argument that it was a blessing in disguise, and people really hammered him for it, and his response was that he was saying it was a blessing in disguise in the sense that this would bring them back to their identity as a team that ran the ball. And so then they just running with Zeke. But Gabe, what been happening when they get a ball to Zeke?
He drops it.
That's right. So what that mean? Andy Dalton had to throw the ball 54 times in the course of that game. That's right. And Andy Dalton looked like what you remembered Andy Dalton to be, except worse. He's in his 10th year in the league, right? If Andy Dalton still had something left, he wouldn't have gotten benched last year for Ryan Finley. Ryan Finley, who may never start another NFL game again. I don't even know if Ryan Finley's in the NFL. But they put him on the oak for Ryan Finley last year, and it was people out here really trying to convince themselves that maybe, just maybe, the Cowboys would just be able to keep it going with Andy Dalton. Now, Can you make the argument that there are a lot of other things that are going on with the Cowboys that are bad beyond Andy Dalton? Certainly. Their offensive line is terrible, for example. That's one of the things that we can point to. So that's not necessarily on Andy Dalton. But come on, dog. I know what a good quarterback behind a bad offensive line looks like. That was a bad quarterback behind a bad offensive line. There's no way around it. That dude just ain't got nothing left. Like, we had him as on the upper echelon of backup quarterbacks, which I think is fair. He is the second best, maybe, backup quarterback in the NFL. The first one is Jameis, right? And I'm not the only person that had thought this perhaps about Andy Dalton maybe being the best backup quarterback in the, you know, in that tier. And if you thought he was the best, you got to admit you'd rather have Jameis than that dude. Because the thing about Jameis, again, is Jameis can go out there and win you a game. It's also possible that he's going to lose you a game, but he can win you a game. I thought that maybe there was a chance myself that Andy Dalton could, like, hold it down for you for a little while, maybe win a game, you know, a couple of them here and there, but you just hope that nothing goes wrong and Andy Dalton doesn't do anything stupid. Nope. I don't think that's going to be it. Don't see that coming. Their backup quarterback is some dude I've never heard of. I think it's Nuchin. Is that what they called him?
I don't know. Isn't that just like a stark example of how few good quarterbacks there are in the league? That you're talking about Andy Dalton as the second best backup in the league, right?
Yes.
In the whole league. So if someone goes down, it's like, that's the second best guy I would like to have to steer my franchise through some stuff. And you're talking about how bad he is.
Yes, you're absolutely correct. Look, there aren't enough NFL quarterbacks to fill out, like, starting spaces. You know what I mean? Like, there are two positions in the NFL where there aren't enough good players to fill out all the starters in the league, and it's quarterback and kicker. Those are the two. So imagine if a team had to go to its backup kicker. Just throw it out there. We got to go to our backup kicker. How petrified would you be at that thought? That is like, nobody's going to go to whoever the other kicker is. That is, in effect, what is going on with people and quarterbacks. Like, the guys just aren't there. I'm looking at the teams in the league right now, and I'm trying to think of maybe a backup quarterback that I missed. Like, maybe one of those guys in San Francisco is up there with Jameis and Andy Dalton as being, like, the backup quarterback that you want to discuss. Maybe, like, Jordan Love, you know, the first-round pick for the Packers. Maybe he's that guy. I don't have a great answer for you on that. Did you see Joe Flacco out there playing for the Jets this weekend? Yo, he's so bad, right? Like, so you are correct. There just aren't really guys out there that are able to do this. But whether they're guys out there or not who are able to do this, it doesn't change the fact that the Cowboys are going to be uproarious this year. And they're going to be uproarious, because let me get a look at this schedule, because I get the feeling that we are still going to have to see them on national television quite a bit, because they kind of like cash money. When it comes, oh, Gabe, we got them playing the Steelers on November the 8th at 4:25. That sounds like the game of the week. The next week, they're playing against the Vikings at 4:25. Retro, Gabe, that also sounds like the game of the week. We got the Cowboys in Washington on Thanksgiving Day. That is, in effect, the game of the week. We got the Ravens and the Cowboys on Fox at 8:20 on December the 3rd. Gabe, that's a primetime placement. As of right now, we have the Cowboys and the 49ers playing on NBC. That is, as of right now. We got the Eagles and the Cowboys on December 27th at 4:25. Which, Gabe, sounds a lot to me like it'll be the game of the week, because there's a good chance that those teams are going to be playing for the division. It will have consequences.
America's team.
Who might go to the playoffs.
Could you do a little quick history bite off of why they're America's team? And why can't we just eschew them aside? Because I don't think growing up I really understood the whole America's team thing with the Cowboys, but I'm also from California where we have like five teams.
Right.
I didn't really understand it.
All right, so if I'm not mistaken, the phrase America's team comes from NFL films. I don't have a great answer for how exactly it is that the Cowboys got to be so wildly popular. Like, the Ice Bowl, like it was, what, 1967 or whatever year they had the Ice Bowl? That broke my daddy's heart, right? The Cowboys had barely been in the league for any period of time, and in that period, he had developed enough of an attachment to them that the Ice Bowl for him was a heartbreaker. Now, I think part of why the Cowboys are so popular and something we got to remember is they're in that division with the Giants, the Eagles, and Washington, which is to say that they had main rivalries in three of, like, at the time, the top seven or eight markets in America. I mean, a lot of those games were being beamed to everybody in America because of who they were playing, you know, just the sheer numbers of who it was going to be. They're also just impeccably and immaculately branded. Like, that's the part we can't lose sight of. The star, the uniforms, all of their stuff, right? Like, all the trim is the cheerleaders. Like, that was in advance in the way that people did football or whatever. But if you are from a place that does not have a football team, chances are the Cowboys are the most popular team in wherever that place happens to be. So, like, you talk to people from Memphis, for example. People from Memphis, there's two teams in Memphis, the Cowboys and the Steelers. It's just a matter of which one you pick. And so I think that also has to do with the fact of the rise of popularity of the NFL in the 1970s. And the Cowboys were always good in the 1970s. Like, you got to remember, they had 20 straight years of being over 500 under Tom Landry. They were always, at the very least, not bad. They were consistently going to Super Bowls, for example. Like, all of that stuff. Like, that is how they get across. And the thing about the Cowboys, for me, as much as people say that we could just push them to the side, people love them, man. Like, you can't make the argument in 2020 that people are fair weather fans by rooting for the Cowboys. I can't even think of a fan base that's more loyal to their NFL team than the Cowboys. I would also say, and I think this part is huge, there is no broader cross-section of America among a fan base than there is with the Cowboys. Like, I went to Jerry World once for the Thanksgiving game. Nothing looks more like America than the parking lot outside of Jerry World before a game. It's a little bit of everybody that's out there, you know? And so as much as people are like, why are we paying attention to them? It's so much more fun to pay attention to them than it is to pay attention to these other teams. Like, you think these other teams are interesting just because they're good? You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't work that way. And so especially since Jerry took over, they're always interesting. The only time I say they weren't interesting was the Dave Campo years. Other than that, in one form or fashion, they are always interesting. And for the better part of the last 15 years, they've always been at least like halfway decent. At least halfway decent. I can't think of a time they stunk like this. Like, I don't understand. At some point, they're going to have to fire the defensive coordinator in the season if they go pretend like they're trying to win the division. Is winning the division a thing that really matters that much? I don't have a great answer for you on that, to be perfectly honest. But if that's something they're going to try to do, that's one of the worst defenses that I have ever seen. Like, Kyler Murray last night wasn't good. Right? He was not. No matter how you look at it, Murray hasn't been good this year. Murray wasn't good yesterday. He was what, like 9 for 24 or something like that. If you take away that 80-yard pass that he threw to Christian Kirk, what are we talking about from Kyler Murray if we do that? If we take that away, 8 for 23 for 108 yards. Like, he was able to move running the ball, and that was cool, but it's not as though they were out there playing great. The Cowboys' defense just stinks. And in the worst kind of way. It's one thing if you got a defense that gives up a lot of big plays through the air, but I just can't imagine how demoralizing it is to just get run through week after week after week. And they had a chance to win some games early when they had Dak out there. They had a chance. I mean, I guess they did win that game against the Falcons. They had a chance to win that game against the Rams. They had another close one against the Seahawks. Like, they had some chances. Now we just gonna be laughing. I found it to be hysterical how bad they wound up being. I'm trying to think of what other teams are like really hilarious when they're bad in this way. Like the Knicks, it used to be like that, but then they were just bad forever. And so it just kind of got old. You know what I mean? But I can't really think of too many other teams that when they're bad, well, the Jets. It's always funny when the Jets, and they are bad. Now they're worse than the Cowboys. They are so bad. So bad. The interesting thing about it with the Cowboys is Cowboys fans aren't even really jerks. They haven't had the room to be jerks in like 25 years. You know what I mean? Like, they're out here what everybody claims that Cowboys fans are out here being what everybody claims that they want to be. Hard, you know, diehard fans. That's what they call them, right? Like, they're there through thick and thin. and everything else. There's a reason why even if the Cowboys are sorry, they're going to keep getting national TV placement because them Cowboy fans are still going to show up and watch. And they be hurt when the Cowboys lost. I remember my mama had a student, my man Willie. You see Willie on a Monday and be like, man, Willie, what's going on? Man, I'm doing better. What happened? Cowboys lost. That was it. You know what I mean? And they're one of these that we think of them as America's team, but they for real Dallas team too. Like, you can't lose sight of that. Like, Dallas, I would say the Texans probably got like 60% of Houston, you know, because there's so many people that are Cowboys fans that are just happen to be there. Austin, that's a Cowboys city. San Antonio, like, you know, they always keep talking about they built that dome in San Antonio, hoping they can get a football team. They got a football team, the Cowboys. Like, ain't no way in the world that's going to happen. Like, it took, I always use this argument to explain, like, how long it can truly take to develop a local fan base. You are too young to remember this, but the Cardinals and the Cowboys were in the same division until 2002, when they went to the four divisions in each conference. The Cardinals were in the NFC East. It took well over, I'd say about at least 20 years after the Cardinals moved to Phoenix from St. Louis, before their games against the Cowboys weren't road games. Like, when they first got there, it would basically be wall-to-wall Cowboys fans. And it's for the reason, remember we talked about this with Vegas and putting a team there. I was like, the problem that you're going to have is for the locals, they got eight chances to see the local team. Those other teams on the schedule got one chance to see their team. So the other people are going to be more incentivized to buy tickets and do what it takes to show up there. You know, so like the first time that they have a Cowboys-Raiders game in Las Vegas, it's going to be packed with Cowboys fans. Just imagine that. You a Cowboys fan and we get to make a Vegas weekend out of this? You know what I'm saying? Like they're going to be wall-to-wall in there. But I used to make that as an argument of how long it takes to truly develop a fan base. Look at what would happen for Cowboys games in Arizona, because those people's favorite team was the Dallas Cowboys. Like, you got to bring up like a whole generation of kids or whatever it is to get there. But like, so like, if they would put a team in San Antonio and they played against the Cowboys, it would be 90% Cowboys. You know what it would be like? It would be like them schools like UCF, USF, Florida Atlantic, Florida International, like all those, you know, these giant schools in Florida, but they came around late because, you know, those are like among like the top 10, top 15 schools in America in terms of population, all those Florida schools. But then people all rooting for Florida State. You know what I'm saying? They still rooting for Miami because didn't nobody grew up rooting for no damn USF? That's just not how it works. That's just not what it is. And so that's kind of where the Cowboys stand in all of this. So they got all these fans everywhere who love them, love them, love them, love them. And we going to be laughing at y'all all year long on national television. And again, normally when a team gets sorry and we thought they were going to be good, they flex them out of those games. Like, I remember one of the first times I did PTI. And I'm talking to the producer and we're trying to figure out what's going to be on the show. And he looked at me and he said something that's obvious, but we had this one topic, we had the Cowboys, and he was just like, just so you know, in my time doing this show, when it comes to ratings, you can't lose with the Cowboys. Like, everybody who talks about how, why do we talk about the Cowboys so much? People watch when we talk about the Cowboys. Like, think about this. The Patriots, with all that winning, because I talked about how the Cowboys, like 20 straight years, you know, were good in that run. For all that winning that the Patriots have done, they are still not a national brand. There's no stadium outside of Boston that people, except maybe like when the Dolphins are terrible, right? But they ain't no real stadium where you're just showing up and it's a bunch of Patriots fans. Like, the Steelers, they got it like that. They're a national brand in that way. The Cowboys are a national brand in that way. There aren't really many of them that are truly and legitimately, like, if the Raiders mess around and stay good, the Raiders were a national brand. Like, I don't know if they can bring it back around like it was before, but they were a national brand. The 49ers, for all those championships they won during that stretch, they never became a national brand. Like, everybody just has to be honest. The Cowboys matter in a way that the other teams don't matter, and it's more fun when the Cowboys are good, and it's really fun when the Cowboys are bad. and they're still going to make the playoffs, I think. Like, we haven't talked about that part. I think is maybe going too far. But think about how sorry that whole damn division is, okay? The team lost to the Giants by one on Sunday. The Cowboys beat the Giants by something like one, right? Like, it was some crazy close game in that one. The Eagles have already lost to the team when the team was playing the quarterback that they think can't do it. You know what the Thursday night game is this week? Eagles and Giants. And buddy, the Giants are boo-boo. They stink. They are so bad. You keep trying to make this Daniel Jones thing happen. They stink. The Eagles, I don't have a great explanation for why they stink, but they stink. They started the year and Carson Wentz stunk, and then Carson stopped stinking. And guess what? The Eagles still stink. Some of it injury. Yeah. I hear you. They stink. I tried to watch some of that game between the team and the Giants over the weekend, and whoo boy, the team stinks. Everybody in that division stinks. Except at least the Cowboys, not all their players stink. Like, I feel like they have some good players. But somehow, after all that talk about Jason Garrett, they would have fired Jason Garrett, it got worse. Think about that. They fired Jason Garrett, it got worse. Jason Garrett's like, huh, y'all got a problem with 8-8, huh? You love 8-8 now. You Cowboys fan, think 8-8 will win this division by four games. You know how many games that division has won not against each other? Two. They have won, the division has won five games in total. The whole division has won five games in total. But think about the two wins. The two wins were the Eagles beating the 49ers with Garoppolo on the high ankle sprain and everything else, right? All as banged up as they were. And that crazy game where the Falcons blew it against the Cowboys. That's it. Before we move on, I just want to make this point once again, because I'm going to make it over and over again until everybody else makes it. Gabe, you're a 49ers fan. You may want to cover your ears, but the reality of the situation is the 49ers had the option in 2017 of keeping Colin Kaepernick. They also had the option of drafting either Deshaun Watson or Patrick Mahomes. They did not have a quarterback. These were their choices. And they decided not to take a quarterback at all in that draft and instead took Solomon Thomas and then traded an asset for Jimmy Garoppolo. And now you have a quarterback that your coach is terrified of, petrified of letting him do anything. You guys could have had one of the best young quarterbacks in the league. Instead, you have Jimmy Garoppolo. Hey, we laugh at the 49ers because everything else we talked about is laughing at the Cowboys. And that is, woohoo! Woo, that gonna be fun.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You know, before I get into the next thing I want to talk about, I meant to mention this one thing. I forgot. Gabe, did you see the story in the New York Times on Sunday that the headline was football's boo birds are all cooped up?
I didn't see that, actually, no.
The subheadline, NFL fans in the Northeast, lusty booers in normal times, have had to watch their team's dim performances from afar without recourse. Quote, I have no way to release my venom, one Jets fan said. Didn't I try to lecture everybody and tell everybody that, look, you got to do the math on whether these football teams are making you happy? You know what I'm saying? Because one thing I do not like as media is that we somehow act like there's something cool about these emotionally unhealthy people who, like, have all this venom, as he called it, and purge it toward a football team. Like, it is its own problem. But I had not really thought about this. The whole damn Eastern Seaboard outside of Baltimore, all y'all teams stink. Like, even the Patriots, your team don't stink, but it ain't what you used to. Just sad. Just bummed out. Let me tell you where they're not bummed out. Tennessee, right? But I want to talk about the Titans because I want to talk about Derrick Henry because I have been thinking about something with football in like this grander macro sense on the evolution of the game and all of this stuff, which is 5 years after Adrian Peterson retires, he's going to go to the Hall of Fame. Right? I don't think we have any question about that. Adrian Peterson is a Hall of Famer and he is going to go. I think it is possible that at some point in between now and then, Marshawn Lynch gets inducted into the Hall of Fame. I don't think his case is as solid as Peterson's is, but, you know, with the championship and just kind of the fame that he has ascended to, I think there's a good chance. But don't forget, writers vote for this, and Marshawn Lynch doesn't like to talk to them. So, you know, but I think Lynch will probably go. Both of those guys were drafted in 2007. What running back drafted since then is going into the Hall of Fame? Who you got? Because I don't have anybody. Well, Ritter's like, yo, that guy's going to the Hall of Fame. Like, maybe Christian McCaffrey will put together enough of a career to get there. Maybe Alvin Kamara will put together enough of a career to get there. But with the way the running back is being de-emphasized, and given that historically the way that you got to the Hall of Fame as a running back was taking 300 carries a year, and guys don't get 300 carries a year anymore, how exactly is it that you're going to get into the Hall of Fame?
I just thought of Frank Gore.
Right, but keep in mind, Frank Gore was drafted.
He came before them, so
yes,
he outlasted them, which is
yes, another level. Yeah. Yes. But, you know, and I think he'll probably, like Frank Gore, so I was looking at Curtis Martin last night as far as Hall of Fame running backs went, because my feeling is, if you let Curtis Martin into the Hall of Fame, then you let Frank Gore into the Hall of Fame. Like, that's my thought. Is Curtis Martin any better running back than Frank Gore was? Now, Curtis Martin had the advantage that he played for two high-profile teams. He played for the Patriots and he played for the Jets. You know what I mean? So he got a... But he only made like Pro Bowl like four times or something like that. There was no time ever that any of us believed that Curtis Martin was the best running back in the league. I don't know how many times we thought that Curtis Martin was the second best running back in the league. But you know how Curtis Martin got to the Hall of Fame? Taking 300 carries a year. That's how he got to the Hall of Fame. And the only difference between him and Frank Gore is Frank Gore only had 300 carries one time in his career. And by the way, when he did that, he ran for like 1,600 yards. You know, but guys don't get 300 carries a year to get into the Hall of Fame. Guess who got 300 carries last year? Derrick Henry. That's who got 300 carries last year. Guess who's leading the league this year with 123 carries? That's right, Derrick Henry. Derrick Henry had 200 yards rushing in his last game. 200 yards rushing. 22 carries for 212 yards. All right. Got you. So through five games, Derrick Henry has 123 carries for 588 yards and six touchdowns. Derrick Henry in his career has a 75-yard run, a 74-yard run, a 94-yard run that he just had this week, and a 99-yard run. Derrick Henry has all of these. Derrick Henry had 12 touchdowns in 2018, 16 touchdowns last year. He has six touchdowns so far in five games. I am saying all of this to say that quietly, right before our eyes, Derrick Henry might be putting together the guts of a Hall of Fame career. And if it were to become a Hall of Fame career, he would wind up, I feel very confident saying, he would be like the last Mohican of that type of running back, like that model of running back. Because look, that's what the Titans are building this around. Like, Tannehill's been pretty good, you know, like way to not be what you were before, all of that stuff. But this is about Derrick Henry. And as much as we were like, do you pay the running back? How much do you give him? So forth and so on. Derrick Henry is 26 years old. Now, 28 is typically when a running back falls off a cliff. But Derrick Henry is 26 years old and averaging 4.8 yards a carry. Like the last three seasons where Derrick Henry has run for 1,000 yards, he's averaged 4.9 yards a carry, 5.1 yards a carry, 4.8 yards per carry. Like, yo, dude, three or four of those for a running back, that should get you in the Hall of Fame. You know? And so I don't care about the analytics part of this, and I'm not using this to judge the analytics folks, right? I'm just saying I understand all their points that they make about the decreasing significance of the running back. Like Aaron Schatz, for example, at Football Outsiders makes the point in his Football Almanac that sack rate is tied to the quarterback. Like no matter how bad the offensive line is, how much a quarterback gets sacked has more to do with the quarterback than it has to do with the line. Because again, you have the option of throwing it away, like all of that stuff. But rushing, he says, is more about the offensive line than it is about the running back. And I think there's something to that. Like, I value his opinion greatly in his analysis. So I think that there is something to that. But that don't mean that there ain't no running back that matters. You know, that there is no running back that can have, like, a demonstrable effect on what's going on here. And this giant man who looks slimmer to me than he did when he was at Alabama, he looks faster to me than he did when he was at Alabama. I guess I'm just saying I don't want to live in a football world where a guy who plays like that and who plays exceptionally in the style of play that he has, I don't like the idea that we just not going to act like that's a big deal. That we just going to shrug this off. Like, I am of the era of kids where you wanted to be a running back, right? Like, you imagine that you were running around. Like, it's the running back is like the decathlete position of the NFL. To me, and I get where everybody comes from, they like all the points, they like all the passing, and you don't want them to be running the ball like they did in 1974 necessarily. But I think an NFL centered around the run is kind of more compelling. Like, there's a different kind of emotional, visceral feel to that kind of grinded out kind of football. Like, I was thinking about Barry Sanders, all right? Before we got to this place with the super athletic quarterbacks out here, right? Like Michael Vick, you know, is a good example to throw out there. Who or what was more exciting than Barry Sanders? Nothing. Now, did the Lions win anything with him? They went to the NFC Championship one time. They won one playoff game. Contrary to popular belief, by the way, the Lions were not terrible for his entire tenure there. They had some pretty good teams while he was there. They were just the Lions, right? But they had some pretty good teams. While he was there, and they invested in offensive lines. Like, I think that the Lions for the Sanders era get a bit of a bad rap. But I don't give a damn if they never won anything. He's Barry Sanders. Like, that's great. Like, I enjoy it. I love it. It is fantastic. And with Derrick Henry, I'm kind of in a similar place there. I like watching that dude play football. I enjoy it greatly. And he's putting up the numbers, and he's logging the carries. So I'm just saying, if he keeps it up, y'all try to join me on the Derrick Henry for the Hall of Fame program. And it's not just about Derrick Henry going to the Hall of Fame. It's about our values and what we believe in. You know what I'm saying? It's about making sure that people understand and appreciate the fact that a guy who can do those things, there should never be a point where we stop being impressed by it. Like, Leonard Fournette had a game last year where he ran for 200 yards. I think it was against Denver. I was talking to Pablo about it. And Pablo was kind of like, hey, well, Leonard Fournette was okay. I'm like, dude, no, that's what it was. He was trying to jump on Minshew's job. Right? And I'm like, dude, Leonard Fournette ran for 200 yards. Like, do you realize how easily we shrug off, even at a time where teams don't run, how easily we shrug off 200 rushing yards, but still get hype about 300 passing?
Was 200 rushing yards ever not a big deal, even for offenses that were centered around the run?
Never, never, never. Like, what got me on this, I think it was in, who did the Titans just play? They played Houston. I saw some recap of that. Barry Sanders, Jim Brown, LaDainian Tomlinson, and I think O.J. Simpson. I think, but I'm not sure. Those are the only guys to have three games in their career with 200 rushing yards. And now Derrick Henry has three games in his career with 200 rushing yards. You see what I'm saying? Like, this is great stuff. Let us give it credit for being great stuff, right? The math don't matter that much. Even if you think the running back don't matter, the running back is still pretty damn cool.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
All right. So I don't really talk too much about the University of Texas football on here for a couple of reasons. One of them is they are pretty consistently sorry, and there's no reason for me to talk to you about a sorry tea. You know, like, I'm not going to do that to you. I think about you before I do this. It ain't about me. This ain't my journal. You know what I'm saying? But there is something fascinating going on with Texas football this year, and it's not really that much of a national topic of discussion, but it matters a lot. All right. So there's this song that they play at Texas games. You probably heard it many times. It's the Eyes of Texas. It sounds like I've been working on the railroad, but it's the Eyes of Texas. Okay. And a tradition of Texas football is after the game, the students stay and the players stay on the field and they do the little hook 'em horns thingy and they all, you know, they sing the Eyes of Texas, right? They do all that stuff. It's a big thing. It's considered to be part of the experience. But the origins of this song point back to a minstrel show. Like, there's a lot that's going on there, and you can look up the details. It's really just not worth it for me to, like, spell it out here. That's the part that you need to know. And there's some people who make arguments against the idea that it ties back to a minstrel show, but that part doesn't matter, right? Black students at the University of Texas have felt this for a while, and many of the players feel this. And so this summer, the players put forth a list of demands that they wanted after George Floyd, you know, and white folks was listening to us in that time. And they came with a bunch of things they wanted, like the names of buildings changed that were tied to the Confederacy or, you know, tied to racists and these things, more acknowledgement and more credit given to, you know, black folks that have made contributions to the University of Texas in the past, all of these things. One thing to remember is that the state of Texas is 12% black. The University of Texas is 5% black. And Texas has a buku black people, just so you get it. But Texas also has a giant Latino population, right? Which kind of skews the numbers. And you see what I'm like, the point that I'm making there is that don't let that 12% part fully fool you. It's a lot of black people. And I guess, and the other point I'm making is the Latino population is not equal to the Latino population at the University of Texas. You see what I'm saying? Like, the school is disproportionately white. The history is very, very much so white. One of the problems that Texas has had in recruiting in past years, not so much now, but definitely in past years, is they had to wash off the legacy of racism. It was a different sell getting black people to go play for the University of Texas, and not necessarily the easiest sell for Texas to decide the black person wanted to play for them. Like, all of these things. Like, race has always been a significant issue in Texas football, except for the Mack Brown era. That's basically the only time where it wasn't something that just really came up. So anyway, some of the players do not want to stand after the game for the Eyes of Texas. They don't want to do it. They are not comfortable with it. And I can't imagine how it feels to you as a black person after you find out that this thing is like tied to a minstrel show. And then you stand in there and you got all these white folks singing this song and it's their favorite song in the world. I can't imagine how that feels in that time. You know, these guys playing all these games, getting taught too crazy in all these places and everything else. Like, they're all very aware of what the racial dynamic is of just watching football, like the stadium experience, what it is. They get that. And then after this, I got to come do this. You know, like, I get, you know, what their level of discomfort is. But it has turned into a controversy because the players made it clear this summer that they didn't want to do it. But the issue wasn't really resolved. And so the athletic director told the boosters that the issue, athletic director's name is Chris Del Conte, told the boosters that the issue had been resolved, basically, that there was an understanding of what was expected of the players during the Eyes of Texas, all right? But the players came out of there thinking that there was an understanding and that everybody understood that they wasn't trying to do it. And so the season has started, and now this has become an ongoing week-to-week controversy. Because it's a bunch of dudes that ain't doing it, right? They feel like they had a deal. They feel like they made it clear that they wasn't trying to do that. And now it's a thing because the boosters are furious about it. They really, really care about this song, all right? And so the boosters are furious with it. And Tom Herman is caught in the middle because he's the coach, right? Now, you guys know I ain't a fan, right? Like, you guys know this about me and Herman. But Herman's doing his right, okay? And what he's doing right is this. He got a choice. He can stand by his players or he can stand by the boosters. He can stand by the AD, okay? Stand by the AD, and you're going to get fired. And you're going to get fired because you're going to lose your team. Stand by your team, and you're probably going to get fired. You know, because I think that boosters in this time are a bit reluctant to fire a coach. You know, in the pandemic, the money situation, all it is, price of crude ain't really so great, like all of that stuff, right? However, for this, they'll fire the coach. We've seen these things happen before, right? They'll fire the coach. Remember that time Gary Pinkle stood with his players when they said that they was going to boycott that game and they didn't fire Gary Pinkle, but Gary Pinkle had to leave because of a cancer diagnosis and he needed to take care of his health. And this is how many years ago now? And we ain't heard nothing from Gary Pinkle since. It sounds like he's doing okay. I could be wrong. You know what I mean? But felt a little shaky. Felt a little shaky. In fact, I was talking to John Shoup. John Shoup used to be offensive coordinator in North Carolina. He was offensive coordinator for a few NFL teams. And his last college job was at Purdue. And when that whole thing happened at Missouri, he sent something out standing with those players. Like saying that he was on their side, one of those situations. But anyway, he put a picture out to set that. He said he was talking to somebody in the media one day. And the person in the media was like, sorry to hear that you're not going to be back next year. And he's like, no one's told me I'm not going to be back next year. And then the season ended. And then he wasn't back next year. I've seen that these things can happen. I look at it, if you're Herman, you're better off going down with your players. You're better off standing with them under these circumstances. You got put into an impossible situation. Your best bet is to keep the players. Like, honestly, I feel like in terms of trying to save your job, you got a better chance if you keep the players than if you deal with this stuff with the boosters. But I wanted to bring this up just because I wanted to give you a chance to think about some context on a larger matter, right? Or a different matter. I mean, larger as it affects more people. But I want to read this statement to you that Chris Del Conte made 5 or 6 days ago, the athletic director at Texas. Many of your questions have been about our student athletes and the confusion about why they have not remained on the field for the eyes of Texas after the games. I, like so many of you, view the song with pride and sing loudly and proudly in honor of the efforts of those who represent and support this phenomenal institution. As much as our student athletes love this university, they have questions about the history of the eyes and concerns about it. As you are aware, this past summer, during the height of civil unrest in our country, some of them brought to our attention their concerns over a number of issues on campus, including the origin of the song. President Hartzell was absolutely clear that the eyes is and will remain our school song, but in an effort to further understand its origins, full history, and how it's evolved over time, he established a committee to study, contextualize, and reclaim the song's origin. We believe it is important to understand the history as we continue to perform it. With that said, I do want to clarify that I have had many conversations with our head coaches outlining my expectations that our team show appreciation for our university fans and supporters by standing together as a unified group for the eyes while we work through this issue. However, like all families who see the world through different lenses, we have plenty of work to do on this subject and will continue to do so. But rest assured, our student athletes love and respect this university very much and are competing their hearts out for it. Gabe, that sounds like the same sort of stuff that people were saying surrounding Kaepernick and the national anthem. Because I feel like it sounds very, very similar, just the rhetoric that's being used here about why it is that people should stand for the national anthem. And the reason I point this out is I have a problem with compulsory patriotism, right? Like, you remember when we talked about Myers Leonard, and when he stood for the national anthem while everybody else was kneeling, right? And I was good with it because I'm like, we don't get to make him not do it. He gets to decide what it is that he does. And that's based on the same logic, right? Like, I just don't think you get to make people do these things. I think it defeats the whole purpose of what you're talking about it once it becomes compulsory. Like, I just don't think you get to make people do that. But at the same time, I understood the argument that came from so many people because of their reverence for the United States and, you know, the way that they believe you are supposed to revere your home country. Just basically their belief in the nation state as a concept, as something that you take pride in that way. I got where people were coming from about that, even if I did not agree with the ultimate conclusion that they were reaching about what should be done by the national anthem. I understood why a lot of people felt that way, and especially given that the national anthem has been conflated with the military. You understand what I'm saying? Like, in a way that wasn't the case before. Like, people think that they are rooting for the U.S. in war whenever they see the flag and all of these things. Again, I don't think those things are correct, but I am giving credence to the fact I get why people feel the way that they do about the flag in large part, right? Like, I get that argument. We're not talking about the flag. We're talking about a school, man. Right? And we're talking about a school that I get it from a lot of the boosters that they've loved for decades, right? But we talking about a school that these dudes just got to, and you know why they there by and large. They there to play football. They're not there because they grew up loving Texas. They might be there because they grew up rooting for Texas football, rooting, but they're not there because they've been loving it their whole lives or whatever. And so I'm hearing this thing from the boosters, and basically what they're asking for is compulsory patriotism toward a song. Like, not again, we're not even talking about the national anthem. We talking about a song based off a song. Like, it's low-key a Weird Al Yankovic situation. Because part of the origins of the song are used to make fun of the president at the time, because he would always say the eyes of the South are upon us, because it was some Robert E. Lee line. See what I'm saying, Gabe? Like, why this is an issue? All right. And so they then converted it to the eyes of Texas as a jab at that then president of the time. Okay? It's a cover song. It is basically a cover song. And the boosters are like, we want our players to show respect for this university. And that's when you realize, man, that stuff about the national anthem, it ain't about America. It ain't about patriotism. It is about control. And it is about, let me get this line, make sure I get this line right. Here we go. With that said, I do want to clarify, I have had many conversations with our head coaches outlining my expectations that our team show appreciation for our university fans and supporters by standing together as a unified group for the eyes while we work through this issue. The word that jumps off the page, the one that got me, appreciation, is all fun and games with black folks until white folks feel like you don't appreciate whatever it is. Like, they want us to appreciate stuff that honestly is very difficult to view through the lens of appreciation, right? But it's all fun and games until white folks feel like you don't appreciate what they've done for you. Now, never mind the transactional nature of the relationship between athletes and schools, right? But we want them to show appreciation. And that's another thing that when you think about the arguments surrounding the national anthem, how quick it got to, you don't appreciate this country even though you make all this money, right? Now we talk about, we're not even talking about the national anthem at Texas. We talking about the cover song. We're not even talking about guys that make a lot of money. We talk about guys who aren't allowed to make money. And you still demanding that they show appreciation for the fans. Why? Because this is about control, man. It is about control, and it is about maintaining a level of subservience of these black dudes that are out here playing. Because again, it's not simply that they not standing, it's the reason why they not doing it. This is a thing about Kaepernick, okay? Marshawn Lynch sat by that water cooler, all them different games. Didn't pay attention to the national anthem, didn't answer no questions about the national anthem. Everybody loves Marshawn Lynch. And that's Marshawn Lynch kicking it like Marshawn Lynch kicks it, right? Everybody loves Marshawn Lynch. Colin Kaepernick explicitly stated that he was doing this because he was standing against the oppression of black and brown people in America. And that is what made him the villain. You can do whatever you want during all that stuff, but if you say that that's your reason why, that you're standing up for black people, now we got a problem. And that's the same thing over there at Texas, man. Like, if somebody said, I think it's against my religion, nobody would have an issue. I mean, I don't know what religion would have a problem with this necessarily, right? You know, Jehovah's Witness, they don't let you pledge allegiance. They don't, like, be pledging allegiance to the flag. I guess you wouldn't be pledging allegiance to the University of Texas either, right? Like, maybe that's their get down. I don't know. But if somebody said it was against their religion, they'd be all right with it. Somebody saying this is against my values, which is in effect the same thing as this is against my religion. No, you got to get out here and show appreciation. Because they can get the idea that you are saying, I will not defer to you because I only defer to some higher power. They got to shrug their shoulders and get that. Like, all right, I see you. I feel you. You know what I mean? But with this, it's just about control. And so I really use this situation with the eyes of Texas, perhaps to reevaluate the situation with the national anthem and Colin Kaepernick. And when you see what those parallels are, you will realize that the common thread between these two things is really just racism. That's it. That one thing ain't really that much about the flag. This other thing ain't really that much about the eyes of Texas. It seems all of it is about A, black people doing what they told, and B, black people appreciating whatever it is that we have received, even if it wasn't that damn much.
We know you can't be on top of all the news and information of the day. No need for the social media feeds. We got you. Now, if you haven't heard.
All right, Bomani, this first story comes from the arts.
I'm Cian Haynes from Time magazine. On October 14th, a Paris court sentenced four African activists with a range of fines up to roughly $1,175 for aggravated theft after they were convicted of trying to remove an African artifact from display at a Paris museum in June. While they avoided a potential prison sentence and hefty fine, Congolese activist Mwazulu Diabanza and other activists from the Pan-African group Unity, Dignity and Courage say that their action at the Musée du Quai Branly Jacques Chirac was not an attempt at theft. Rather, in their view, it was an act of active diplomacy by a group that believes African wealth should return to and belong to Africans. The ruling came amid broader debate about the restitution and repatriation of African objects, many of which were stolen during colonial-era expeditions, from European museums back to their sites of origin, and in a year when legacies of colonialism have become flashpoints in the Black Lives Matter movement across Europe. The presiding judge overseeing the case told the Paris court on September 30th that the observers were witnessing two simultaneous trials, one judging the activists and another trial, that of the history of Europe, of France with Africa, the trial of colonialism, the trial of the misappropriation of the cultural heritage of nations. Diabanza, who has led similar actions at other European museums this year, told Time in advance of the ruling that the French state is resistant to any change in its colonial, imperialist and repressive policies. You don't ask a thief for permission to take back what he stole.
All right, so I went to the Met not that long ago. And Gabe, you ever been to the Met?
Yes, I have.
Have you been through like the Egyptian section?
Yes, I have.
All right. First of all, wasn't nobody ahead of the game like the Egyptians, right? Like, I feel like the Egyptians is like if you drop Randy Moss off in 1930s NFL, like nobody was stunting harder than them. They were ahead of everybody on the science, like everything else. They were so far ahead of everybody else. I love going through the Egyptian exhibits at the Met. And you do that, and then you stop, and you're like, why in the world is this stuff here?
Yes. Have you ever been to the British Museum in London?
I have not.
The British Museum is the most impressive collection, and I say collection, of historical artifacts that I have ever seen. It is unbelievable. To your point about the Egyptian heritage section, like in terms of artifacts, it's unbelievable what they have. And then also the same thing with the section on like Greek history. When you think of like ancient Greece and like Athens, you think of like those white columns and stuff like that, that sort of building. It's there. It's at the British Museum. Like they have it.
Yeah. I'm like, why do we have this stuff? Like this is when you stop and think about it, this is kind of not cool. You know, this is it. Like I went, I think they closed it, but there was a museum in Paris with a bunch of artifacts of indigenous people of around the world. I think it's Museum de Branly Quai or something like that. I think that's what it was. I went to it. The stuff was really great, but I was like, yo, why is this stuff here? At every turn, I'm just like, why is this stuff here? And I'm with these folks. They're like, why do you have our stuff? For what? What's the point? Why do you have our stuff?
And it's all colonialism. Right? Where countries like the UK and France and the United States went around to the rest of the world, pillaged all the artifacts, brought them back, and said, hey, this is the foreign world. Just with the price of admission, you get to experience the rest of the world. Are you of the opinion that all these artifacts need to be returned?
I mean, there's no real argument against it. Need to be, the phrasing gets a little tricky. Should be, yes. I don't think there's any argument against the should be. Why should this stuff be here? That's all I'm asking. Why should this stuff be here? Like, if the Met want to open an Egypt location with their stuff, why not? Make it a chain.
That's actually not a bad idea.
Just saying.
The only argument against it is for the enjoyment of the white people in these countries.
Yep.
That's the only argument. And what's so sad about it is these white countries at large are the ones who have the money, right?
Yep. It also doesn't help that they've robbed these people of everything else they have. Like, if it was just a matter of, like, we ain't really do nothing to them, but we came up on some of their stuff. No, you have robbed them at every turn.
And there's pride that comes with that history, that historical artifact, right? So these countries, right, like, what they're most proud of, can be most proud of at least, is that time in their history. And they don't have it.
Nope.
Can you imagine that with the U.S. and you go to some sort of, you know, like U.S. history museum? Can you imagine everything that this country could be proud of? Those things were pillaged, right, and they're somewhere else.
They're at a massive museum complex in Kinshasa. People would get to point D.
And you'd have to pay money to go see it. Unbelievable. Could you imagine being someone of Egyptian descent or someone from Egypt going to London and looking around, having to pay to go to the British Museum and see your own country's history locked up somewhere?
That's bananas.
Unbelievable. All right, this next story comes from Defense.
Hi, I'm Brandi Vincent, a reporter at NextGov. The U.S. military, as I've detailed in a recent piece, is prototyping augmented reality for dogs in a bid to boost safety. Usually, when embarking on dangerous search and rescue missions or hunts for explosive devices, military canines are guided by hand signals, laser pointers, or with walkie-talkies strapped to their backs. This at times can cause confusion for the animals or put the human steering them at risk of exposure. Now, several arms of the Defense Department are working with a Seattle-based startup to prototype augmented reality goggles designed to provide military dogs with clear visual cues directly in the glasses. The dog's handlers would also be equipped with the capability to actually see from the animal's point of view and a means to give commands while staying completely unseen. The startup behind the prototype, Command Site, was founded in 2017 by a man who hoped to help close the gap in human-animal communication. Fast forward to now, and that company has already completed the first phase of a small business innovation research program steered by the Army Research Office and was selected for more funding through phase two to further refine the goggles. Another DoD office additionally put up funding in support of the next phase of work, and the company is also collaborating directly with Navy Special Forces to build prototypes that are custom fitted to and will be tested on their existing military working dogs. Sights are set on getting these into the hands of soldiers in just a few years, and scientists within the military working dog community are really excited about the tech's potential to help them probe dogs' perception and behavior in groundbreaking new ways.
Yo, Gabe, I don't know how I feel about the future. How about you?
You mean a future where dogs are half dog, half robot?
Yo, it's Terminator dogs. This is all fun and games until they turn on us, man. We're not prepared for that.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like a lot of the reaction to this story on the web and on Twitter was kind of like, oh, we can invest money in augmented reality for dogs, but like we can't pay for healthcare, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I see that.
There is a discussion to be had around that, certainly. There also is a discussion to be had about augmented reality for dogs, which is kind of nuts.
Yeah, I just don't think we need all this. You know what I'm saying? And I also want to point out this sentence from the story itself. Because, you know, everything's a community, right? Quote, "The military working dog community is very excited about the potential of this technology." The military what? The military working dog community.
Yeah, I would like to see the kind of bulletin board or like the feature request board for the military working dog community, where they're kind of like, all right, you know, we're doing okay right now, but we could be really that much better if we had X.
Yes, who's dreaming up these things for the military dog to do?
The German Shepherds.
Yeah, yeah. Like, who's cooking this? Man, 2020, man, it's bananas.
Requests coming out from the dogs now.
Yes.
First, they want grain-free kibble. Number two, they want augmented reality.
They're going to be like, you know, like it's a whole different generation of dogs. Like, you think about this. You realize there's a whole generation of kids that don't have to wear whack glasses?
Oh, yeah, big time.
Right? They have no idea what the glasses life was like for the kids back in the day. These new dogs, they ain't going to have no idea, man. You know what I'm saying? What it used to be like. You had to use your own two eyes back in the day to go sniff out their minds.
Oh, my gosh. All right, this last story comes from Health.
This is Sarah Fisher, media reporter for Axios. This week, my colleague Courtney Brown and I wrote about the industries that won't recover without a vaccine. Basically, industries that were once expected to recover after these initial lockdowns early in the spring are now looking unlikely to bounce back until a vaccine arrives. And that's mostly because people are reserved around things like indoor activities and public transportation, things where they're inside and where the virus can easily spread. What we found is that CEOs of some of these battered industries are starting to caution their investors and saying, look, don't expect there to be much movement until there's a vaccine. In the entertainment industry, the movie industry is being completely wiped out. Theaters unable to fill seats because studios won't put major blockbusters in until 2021. You have concert and live venues that are begging Congress for relief packages. Broadway said it would extend its shutdown until next summer. Tourism and travel are also being hit. Tourism-related industries like hotels and resorts, they were never expected to recover quickly, but a recent announcement from Disney that it was laying off 28,000 people due to pandemic-related headwinds suggests that it's going to be even harder for them than they expected. Cruise lines are also delayed in opening back up, most of them not expecting to do so till next year. Airlines are furloughing people in the tens of thousands, and many of their CEOs have said there's nothing we can do to bounce back until there's a vaccine. Bars and restaurants remain largely shut, and for those that are operating, many have to focus on transforming their businesses to operate outside. Same thing with gyms and boutique fitness classes, all of which that are trying to reroute virtually. Even leisure, things like amusement parks and museums, are going to be forced to remain shut until there's a vaccine that's widely available. The bottom line is that even when there is a vaccine, a lot of these industries may not recover until the virus is completely under control. And while we hope that that's in 2021, we don't know for sure.
Yo, let me tell you something I saw yesterday, just to let you know how real things are and how many things there are to consider that we ain't thinking about. This is from the Wall Street Journal. I feel like I just need to read the headline and the subheadline to you. Coronavirus threatens to push the childcare industry over the edge. Daycare enrollment is down sharply. Some centers have closed. More could follow. Like, a whole lot of people just can't afford to have their kids in these daycares, and so they're keeping them at the house. And a lot of these daycares can't be open, and the costs are rising because they have to do all these things to sanitize and all the measures and everything that they have to take. What that's also doing is pulling women out of the workforce. And it's a lot of women who are now having to take care of children. That's the levels on this that we got, that there's so many to think about as to what, you know, what the effects are. Because, we talk about like the live venues, they talk about the restaurants and all those things. Yo, this has the potential to shut down the daycare business, which is something that we've grown accustomed to, guys. You can't just take them over to Big Mama's house like you used to. This is where we are.
And the comfortability with working from home now kind of raises the thought in people's minds that, oh, well, I don't need daycare, I guess. I can get by without it just because I'm home. I can kind of pseudo look after my kids while I'm working. And then the level of productivity changes.
Yeah, no, also people have figured out they can't really do it.
Yeah.
They just have to. Like Peter King mentioned something. Aditi Kingbala works at the NFL Network. She's had different instances where she's been doing Zooms and her kid in background screams or whatever, and somebody, some jerk sent her something. And Peter King wrote about her response because he talked to her about it. And he was like, I think the tweet says something like, I'm drowning. You know, like, kids are not here for you to do all that work. Like, in their presence, that's not how it goes. They need things. Like, raising a child is work. That's why the daycares exist in the first place. Like, if you could just do your job with your kids around, people's kids would just be at offices. The reason they're not is because they can't.
Yeah, it's the lack of respect for the daycare workers.
It's just been taken as a given. Like, it's just something that we haven't thought about. And I don't know, and nobody knows how many daycare centers are going to survive. You know, so like, yeah, the theaters and stuff, yeah, I mean, it'd be messed up if we don't have them, right? What's going to happen to that stuff is just going to get a lot more expensive and they're going to be a lot fewer of them, you know, at least in the short run when they first come back. Like, all that stuff is bad, but it's so much deeper than I think that people have really wrapped their minds around.
Hey, this is Bomani. You have reached the right time voicemail. Say whatever you want. Get creative with it. But this is your place to talk back to the show. So talk back. Peace.
All right, Bomani. So we had an interesting series unfold before our eyes this past week. My squad, the Los Angeles Dodgers, played your squad, the Atlanta Braves. We haven't really talked about it at all on the podcast, which is fine. Which is fine. I respect that. I respect your desire to stay away from it. That's cool with me.
Hold on. Hold on. I want to make sure that people understand this. I did not watch any of the games. Just so you know. I did not. I did not immerse myself in this. I felt a little optimism. My brother and I talked about it. And I was like, I'll be happy for the Braves if they win. But I didn't like get on it. I didn't. Because you know damn well if I had, you'd have heard from me about Kershaw. But you didn't. Because I didn't jump in on it in that way. You know? I would also like to note you'll never be talking about the Dodgers till, you know, October, November.
Yeah, and you want to know when I started watching the Dodgers?
October.
Game 7.
I didn't even get to that.
Because I can't take it anymore. I can't take it anymore. I can't take another
What can't you take? Going to the playoffs every year?
Heartbreak. Real heartbreak, man.
I guess they haven't won a World Series in your life. They have in mine, but they haven't won a World Series in your life. But they've been giving you things to watch for the last few years. You know what I'm saying? Like, you sound greedy to me. They don't sound like they really done you as bad as you claim.
Yeah, so people love rubbernecking, right?
Yes.
You don't love rubbernecking as it relates to when I'm watching Kershaw give up homers in the postseason. Of course, his neck is built out of rubber at this point because he throws it and then he's got to look over his shoulder to watch the ball go into the stand. Can't take it anymore. But alas, here we are. The Dodgers beat the Braves. And so they let you down. I know you weren't all the way back in, but they let the Atlanta fan base.
It went up. Yeah, I mean, they did a thing. They were up 3-1.
Yeah, damn. So what Bomani thought would be interesting and fun to do was to reach out to the fans, the listeners, and discover what time that your team let you down and what you did as a result of it. Our first comes from Gunner in Texas.
The biggest disappointment as a Falcons fan, the Super Bowl, without a question. I was watching it with a group of friends, and we had some friends show up late because they were driving back into town. And I think that was the point the Falcons were still up 28-3. And the Patriots scored, and one of my friends said, hey, what if they blow this? I was like, nah, they're not going to blow this. Patriots scored again. And he said, hey, you know it's coming. And I said, nah, like we're good. It's fine. The Patriots scored again. And I was starting to sweat. Then Patriots scored again and finally took it to overtime and won. And everybody was laughing. Group of people, didn't know half of them. And I chucked my phone across the room. And then I had to do the walk of shame across the living room to find out that my screen was cracked. After this Cowboys game a couple weeks ago, I got off that Falcons narcotic, and my life has never been more joyous.
Wow, she was ecstatic in your misery.
Sounded like she was ecstatic to have him be free of that misery.
Oh, got you, because he was bringing the misery to her. Totally makes sense. He guess he's a little bit young, because, I mean, that Super Bowl thing must have been terrible, but when you lose a Super Bowl before it starts because the man of the year gets caught soliciting a prostitute, I'm telling you, man, that feel worse. I feel a lot worse, man.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the biggest loser, aside from yourself, right, is when it is your spouse, your partner, who has to deal with the depression that comes with being a fan of a team that sucks or being a fan of a team that lost that given day. Like you were talking about before, hey, what's wrong? Cowboys lost.
Yeah. But I feel like being a fan of a team that stinks, you just got to do it right. You know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, for example, many of you are fans of athletes who are not very good. That's right. I'm talking about your kids. You know, and you find a way to still love them without, like, getting all buried and heartbroken because they lose. You know what I'm saying? Like, just imagine that those teams are your mediocre kids.
100%. We got a Jets fan. The guy didn't leave his name. We got a Jets fan here. It's good.
The 2015 season, the Ryan Fitzpatrick, Brandon Marshall, New York Football Jets. It was Todd Bowles' first season as head coach. And we were heading into the final week where we were playing Buffalo with a 5-game win streak. We were 10-5. All we had to do was beat Buffalo, who was playing for nothing and was coached by our former coach, Rex Ryan. We just had to beat them, and then we get to go to the playoffs for the first time since Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch went to the conference championships in 2010. You already know what happened, Bo. Ryan Fitzpatrick threw 3 interceptions, 2 in the end zone in the fourth quarter. We lost. We didn't go to the playoffs. And I was furious for 3, maybe 4 years after this happened. The worst part, Bo, that week before the game, I was so convinced that we were going to beat the Bills that I ordered a Ryan Fitzpatrick jersey to wear during the playoffs. You know when it showed up, Bo? The day after he threw 3 interceptions in the fourth quarter. The worst part of all this, I'm still not off that narcotic, Bo. Give me the strength. How do I let go of these terrible New York Football Jets?
Yo, I honestly don't even know what to tell this dude, because if you were dumb enough to buy a Ryan Fitzpatrick jersey just because they was 10-5, you're hopeless. I can't do anything for you. Like, your judgment is dreadful. I would be curious to know other things that you have done in your life that indicate how awful your judgment is.
He said, I was furious with them for 3 or 4. I thought the next thing he was going to say was like 3 or 4 weeks, 3 or 4 days, 3 or 4 months. No, 3 or 4 years. He's been furious, but he hasn't really had much to be happy about, I guess, right?
I do not understand rooting for the Jets. They are so loyal to them, and it seems like the payback is just not there at all. I do not get it. I do not. They're the worst kind of bad this year, because there's, as I've learned with Texas in the last 4 years, it gets way worse when you hate your coach. When you hate the coach, everything is so much worse.
It's a bad scene. This last one is from Joel at Al Dafra Air Base.
The team that let me down the most, 2002 Sacramento Kings. Don't know what else needs to be said. I was 10 years old. I just watched the just absolute blasphemy that was Game 6. Shouldn't have even been in Game 7, but, you know, we're there. We're at home. No one can hit a shot. Pedro Stojakovic airballing threes. Nobody can hit a free throw. I remember being 10 years old and leaving the room in the fourth quarter because a deep part of my soul just told me they don't have it. Was not meant to be. Fortunately, I still haven't quit that narcotic, but at this point, I don't think anything's going to make me.
Everybody keeps saying they ain't going to be in it. Don't hear much about them actually letting it go.
He said, fortunately, I'm not off that narcotic yet. Have I told you the story about me being a Kings fan before I was a Lakers fan?
Yes.
Yeah. So if what Joe described was not going to kill you as a Kings fan, late 2000s, they let go of Rick Adelman, right? Best coach in the team's history. One of the best coaches in the league. Let go of Rick Adelman. Get rid of Mike Bibby. Get rid of Bobby Jackson. Get rid of Doug Christie. Get rid of Pedro Stojakovic. Trade C-Webb to the 76ers. Get rid of Vlade Divac. Fire the GM, Jeff Petry. And what do they do? There's a draft, and they draft Spencer Hawes. That is the day that my Kings fandom died.
What's Spencer Hawes do to you?
He was the epitome of like that era of draft pick where it's just like, oh, he's tall. He's a center. He's going to be just fine in the NBA. No. No.
Oh, wow. They took him the pick after Joakim Noah. But to be fair, I'm looking at the rest of the draft, and there was not much better they could have done.
Yeah, it was just like the final note on a larger concerto of Kings just...
Well, here is what happened, and this has to stink, right? You guys had to pick after the last good player in the draft.
Yep, and this was like the start, you know, if they're wiping the slate clean as a franchise, which is what they did, they're like, hey, we're turning that chapter on the best period in this team's history, and what are we going to do? This is our first pick for this new era of Kings basketball, and that first pick is Spencer Hawes.
Damn. Whew. Glad I don't root for bums anymore. But ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassain handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Thank you to our sponsors. Also, thank you to our If You Haven't Heard contributors. Thanks to Cillian Haynes, senior reporter for Time. Check out her story on the restoration of historic artifacts to Africa. Thanks to Brandy Vincent of NextGov. Check out her story on military dogs with augmented reality goggles at nextgov.com. And thank you to Sarah Fisher of Axios. Check out her story on industries that will not recover without a vaccine. Remember, subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.